From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, Ed Begley Jr. talks with us about his roles in Saint Elsewhere and She-Devil, his days as a stand-up comic, and growing up the son of an Academy Award-winning actor. Also, Matt Groening, syndicated comic, describes all the ways that life is hell. Now he's showing that Christmas can be hell, too, with his cartoon family, The Simpsons. Groening's cartoon family is getting their own TV series. Rock critic Ken Tucker reviews the music of some Joni Mitchell sound-alikes. And film critic Stephen Schiff reviews the film Enemies, A Love Story, starring Ron Silver, Angelica Houston, and Lena Olin. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Frank Stacio. Chileans voted to elect a civilian successor to military president Augusto Pinochet today, and early results show opposition candidate Patricio Aylwin heading for a comfortable victory. The voting was marred by the death of a policeman in an incident the government described as a terrorist provocation. Both the government and the opposition blame the incident on extremists, opposed to Chile's orderly return to democracy after 16 years of right-wing military rule. In Prague today, the new Czechoslovakian foreign minister said his government would seek to negotiate the withdrawal of 80,000 Soviet troops currently stationed in that country. David Darcy reports.
In his first news conference since being named foreign minister on Sunday, former dissident and opposition civic forum activist Jiří Dinspier says the country's new coalition government would remain in the Warsaw Pact while still seeking an eventual pullout of Soviet troops from the country, a position first proposed by communist former prime minister Ladislav Adamets, who resigned a week ago. Dinspier also sought to begin healing the wounds from the Soviet-led Warsaw Pact invasion of Czechoslovakia in 1968 by promising visas to virtually all Czechoslovak exiles denied entry to the country since then for political reasons. He also said that all foreign ministry employees dismissed for political reasons after 68 could return to their jobs. For National Public Radio, this is David Darcy in Prague.
More troop cuts are being ordered in the U.S. by Defense Secretary Dick Cheney in order to meet new budget balancing requirements for the current fiscal year. NPR's David Malpas reports.
Because of automatic budget cuts triggered by the Graham-Rudman law, the military services have to trim $1.7 billion from their 1990 budgets. Today, the Pentagon announced that to achieve the savings, military troop strength will be cut 2% this year instead of the previously planned 1%. So in addition to the 21,000 personnel reduction ordered earlier, another 25,000 slots will be eliminated, none, however, from the Navy. Pentagon spokesman Pete Williams.
That means it'll be about half Army and half Air Force. It's certainly significant to the services, but it's not an enormous bite.
Williams said most of the reductions could be achieved through attrition and early retirements. The revised personnel figures will still leave more than 2 million men and women in uniform. I'm David Malpas in Washington.
A Muslim extremist group in Lebanon today threatened to kill Pope John Paul II because it said he supports Chieftain Christian Army Chief General Michel Aoun. Leftist and Muslim extremist groups accused the Vatican of backing Aoun, who refuses to submit to the authority of the Syrian-backed President Elias Harawi. The group called the Organization of the Defending of Oppressed issued the threat in a statement sent to an international news agency. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average fell more than 7 points today, close at 2753.63. This is NPR News. 7 men in Boston have been indicted for importing 30 handguns to be used against a street gang. The guns were smuggled into Massachusetts on a Greyhound bus from Georgia. Elizabeth Arnold reports.
26 semi-automatic pistols and 14 revolvers were allegedly brought into Boston to arm a street gang, according to U.S. Attorney Wayne Budd. Budd says 7 Boston men paid about $10,000 for the weapons, which were brought to the city on 4 separate trips on board Greyhound buses from Georgia. Special Agent Terrence McArdle says tracing led to the discovery of the import operation. 5 of the men were arrested today. 2 others were already in custody on similar charges. The guns were allegedly imported for use against a Roxbury street gang. The state of Massachusetts has some of the most stringent gun laws in the country. FBI checks, permits, and ID cards are required to possess a gun, and a mandatory sentence of 1 year in jail is imposed for failure to register firearms. For National Public Radio, I'm Elizabeth Arnold.
Scientists reported today the discovery of North America's oldest fossils of mammal ancestors, solving a long-standing mystery. The 225-million-year-old remains that predate dinosaurs have been discovered in Virginia, about 115 miles south of the nation's capital. Researchers from the Smithsonian Institution and Columbia University discovered the rare fossils of mammal-like reptiles called cynodonts, which previously had only been found in South America, China, and South Africa. During the era of cynodonts from about 240 million to 205 million years ago, scientists think the Earth had only one giant continent called Pangaea, and the mammal-like reptiles should have been common across the entire landmass. Pangaea broke up into modern-day continents, and cynodont fossils should have been found on all of them, but until the Virginia discovery, only one cynodont jaw had been found in the entire northern hemisphere. I'm Frank Stachow, National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Ed Begley Jr. became a household name in the 1980s through his role on St. Elsewhere as the self-absorbed young Dr. Victor Ehrlich. He's the son of the late actor Ed Begley, who won an Academy Award for his role in Sweet Bird of Youth. After playing many small and supporting roles in such films as Cat People, This is Spinal Tap, Eating Raoul, and Transylvania 6-5000, Ed Begley Jr. is now getting starring roles. He co-starred in Paul Bartel's comedy, Scenes from the Class Struggle in Beverly Hills, and now he's starring in She-Devil. He plays an accountant married to a fat woman played by Roseanne Barr. He begins a torrid affair with one of his clients, a best-selling romance novelist played by Meryl Streep. His wife seeks revenge. After burning down her house, she takes their children to be with their father in what she decides should be their new home, Meryl Streep's mansion. Barr and the children find Streep and Begley in a bubble bath, naked in the middle of an embrace.
Andy!
I found him!
Hi, Daddy.
Who let you in here, Garcia?
Ruth, what the hell do you think you're doing?
Andy, Nicolette, this is your new home. I'm sure you'll be very happy here.
Ruth, you are really depraved.
Someone get this deranged woman out of here. Garcia!
You take care, kids. And remember, no matter what, I love you both very much.
Ruth? Ruth, if this is your idea of a joke, it's not funny.
She-Devil, I think, continues a recent cycle of roles for you in playing the sexual athlete who doesn't realize he's a self-absorbed jerk. What started this new image in the movies for you?
That's very well put, Terry. I've never had it told quite in such a flattering fashion. Yeah, I've played a bit of that on television. Victor Ehrlich was a fellow who was a less than scrupulous character, and Bob Patchett, you know, hits a new low, an absolute nadir of... a male bravado and foolishness. So, I enjoy playing those kind of parts. It's different. I've played enough sort of white bread, guy next door parts for years, the best friend, what have you. This is nice. I enjoy it. My idol is Dabney Coleman. I'll tell you that much. So I want to be something like him.
Now, has it changed your self-image at all to be seen by the public now as, something, as someone who plays... Who plays an egomaniac a lot of the times, and someone who's, misses the point a lot.
Well, the sad thing is it's only seemed to have helped. I'm not sure what that says about people want or women want. I don't know. I guess they know it's not really me, and, it's a role that I'm playing, and I certainly like playing it.
Mm-hmm. Now, in She-Devil, you play opposite Meryl Streep, and... You used to do stand-up before you started acting or while you were already acting, and she basically comes to this movie from a lot of dramatic films, dramatic roles. Did you prepare really differently for your scenes together?
No, I didn't. I had done some stage myself, certainly not the amount that she has done over the years, the public theater and the Yale Drama School and what have you, but she has quite a background in comedy, too, at those two places I just mentioned, and is rather well known for it in those circles, and a very funny lady. And no, I didn't prepare for it any differently. It was a good part to play.
I guess I was wondering if you and she came at the roles differently, if you had different ways of preparing for a comedy.
I came at it with kind of a pre-Elizabethan spin, and she did that, postmodern metaphor spin on it, I think.
Right.
That's the kind of thing she did with it. I don't know. I tried to bring the the greatest amount of reality I could to Bob Patchett, and hopefully I did that on occasion, and she certainly did. She's very funny. She's, you know, the hit of the movie, in my opinion, and I greatly admire her. I did before I met her, and even more so now. She's really a miracle of a human being.
How much of a turning point in your career was it to get the role of Victor Ehrlich on St. Elsewhere?
That was the greatest, you know, single part or break I had had at that point. At that point, I'd been working about 15 years, and I was literally starting to consider, I don't know about packing it in, but maybe moving, you know, to Atlanta and, you know, doing, you know, trying to be a big fish in a small pond or something. Because I'd been working a lot, had had parts, had had a few spurts of minor success, but nothing really good. And I was thinking of relocating. And then this part came up, the role of Peter White on St. Elsewhere. And I didn't get it, went to Terrence Knox.
Yeah, this was the rapist.
Yes, and that was a regular part, you know. And so they kind of threw me a bone. They said, you want to play this guy Ehrlich? He's in one or two episodes. I went, great, you know, that's better than nothing. And took the part, and that blossomed into six episodes and then a regular character. And pretty soon Peter White, you know, even, you know, went on to other things. And I stuck around. So I was very, very fortunate, I think, to work with these good people and to be with it the entire 6 years. It was a great opportunity. It was a wonderful, wonderful part. At that point, I'd never had a part that good in TV or films. It was, you know, the nicest script I'd worked on to date.
Did you make any suggestions for how the character should change or develop over time?
More than suggestions. I did have some input into that. I gave them cash. You know, that's not traceable. There's no tax ramifications. There's not a nasty check that you can go through bank records and find. Just give the writers cash. I urge young actors out there, that's the best way to really win them over. I don't know how it happened. You know what really happened? I think the big turning point in making my character surface on the show had nothing to do with me. It was Bill Daniels, who's a very talented man and a good friend, and his character and mine were written in one scene together, and it worked very well. He knows how to make that sort of thing work, and physically it worked. You know, there's a Mutt and Jeff thing happening, and all of a sudden, all the writers went, we know how to write this. You know, that's kind of an interesting dynamic. You know, the, you know, shorter, you know, surgeon, the highly skilled surgeon, haranguing this younger, kind of sometimes inept, you know, tall, goofy guy. It was something fun to write, and it worked well, I think.
My guest is actor Ed Begley Jr. When you were getting a lot of small parts in movies, what would you try to do in a film so that you knew you'd be noticed? Is there a way of calling attention to yourself in a small role?
There are a few things you can do. It's good to bring in some novelty store items often, you know, something that makes noise. There's a scratching thing you can do in your face in the background, even out of focus. It's very noticeable. There's a way to fluff your hair up or just, you know, pick in your ear. There's things that you can do. I'm talking about highly skilled, sophisticated things as an actor, as an artist to do in the background or even better in the foreground. If you're in the foreground, you have a much better chance. I don't know. I think in the smaller roles, you know, sometimes it's easier, sometimes it's harder to play these small parts that have these, you know, brief moments. You want to make something out of it. How do you get the history of a character, you know, in a line or two? It's very difficult. But I had a very small part in the movie Spinal Tap, but I'm quite proud of it.
Your part in that. You're the drummer during the Paisley period.
Exactly. I die in a bizarre gardening accident, and yeah, one of the many drummers that seem to come and go.
Yeah, and you're in this flashback sequence. It's a sequence where they're showing the band back in the 60s on a British TV rock.
That's right.
Show,
there's kind of a kinescope of them as the Thamesmen.
That's right. That's right.
A past incarnation of the wonderful Spinal Tap group. And it was great fun. I had no lines, but I have some stellar moments, if I may be quite arrogant there, just playing the drums and looking rather goofy.
You did stand-up comedy years ago. Can you give me a sense of what your act was like? Did you do characters? Did you do monologues?
Have you seen Robert Klein's act?
Yeah, I have.
It's nothing like that.
Oh, great.
My act was
okay.
Nothing like that. It was, what did I do? I did a lot of different characters. I was a prop comic. I'm embarrassed to say.
Really?
Yes, I had a big trunk, and I had wigs and different nun's habit and a police uniform and hand props and all sorts of products. It was a lot of television parody, a lot of different characters that came and went within the course of the, you know, very fast-paced 30 minutes I was on stage. I had slides. I had audio playback. I like to keep things as complicated as possible so they could go wrong and you'd have something to blame.
Well, it distracts attention from the lines.
Exactly. If the material's a little weak, you know, put a slide up and try and get a cheap laugh.
Could your ego stand either getting heckled or not getting laughs on a bad night?
I had very few bad nights. I mean, like, you know, low laugh or no laugh nights. Really only about five. And there was one that was particularly devastating. I was playing at the Bottom Line. I was opening for Eric Carmen and the Raspberries back when he was with that group.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a real rough crowd. I had had a good night the night before and the night after I had a good night. But it was just a real tough group that was there. It was kind of the Queen's Quaalude crowd, I think. And I was hitting them with all the material, the A material, and I was getting nowhere. And one of them literally had some drumsticks in their hand, in his hand. A fellow had these drumsticks, and he was kind of banging on the stage and going, you know, whoa, dude, you know, get off the stage, okay? You know, there's a couple of California people there, too. And it was a rough crowd.
So what happened?
I was crushed. I was just crushed. I didn't want to go on. I didn't want to perform anymore after that. Because usually I'd come out and I had a strong opening, this thing in a police uniform, and I'd get big laughs and go from there and, you know, possibly, you know, fail over the course of the evening. But start off with a nice opening and a good, you know, resounding bit of laughter. But this was rough. I couldn't get anywhere with these people. And I think I quit soon thereafter.
Oh, you really did, huh?
Yeah.
And what did you do right after?
What did I do? I went into the lucrative rug shampooing field, I think. I did blade sharpening at home for a while. I went back to doing smaller parts in television and motion pictures. The reason I did the act was I was starting to feel like I was never going to get any big parts in films or TV, you know, just waiting around for it. So I thought I'd kind of write a part for myself and do it on stage. And I did, and had some success with it, doing the clubs for a while.
Mm-hmm. I'll tell you what, let's take a short break and then we'll talk some more. My guest is Ed Begley Jr., and this is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
My guest is Ed Begley Jr., and for years he played Dr. Victor Ehrlich on TV St. Elsewhere. He's also appeared in the films The Accidental Tourist, This is Spinal Tap, and scenes from The Class Struggle in Beverly Hills. He co-stars in the new film She-Devil. Your father was the actor Ed Begley.
Yeah.
Did you think of him as a great actor when you were growing up?
It didn't occur to me that he was, you know, great or even an actor for a while. You know, I thought everybody's dad did Broadway plays and went back to California and did movies and TV shows. I didn't get it for a while. And then when I saw that he did that, I thought he was fine. It wasn't until years later that I began to appreciate the quality of his work. You just don't see it at the time. You know, you see all the flaws and the him running late for an appointment and getting in the car and rushing us here and there, and that's all you see about it. You don't see the work for a while. Then you finally do. You look at some of the good movies, 12 Angry Men or Patterns or Sweet Bird of Youth, and you see what a fine actor he was, what good work he did.
Did he ever use acting to play up the role of father?
Yeah, he had a rather resounding voice. It worked. It was quite effective when he wanted to get a point across or to beckon me to the front or rear door of the house. It was kind of an, Eddie! You know, it's kind of a, it had a certain authority to it, you know. That would get me running. And he had a whistle, too, that I could hear literally for blocks. He had a whistle that I could hear in excess of one block. I could be outside of the, you know, the one block radius of my house, and he would do that whistle, and I'd come on bike or foot.
Was that embarrassing?
It probably was pretty embarrassing, but I came just the same, embarrassed or not. I was there lickety split.
Now, you went to military school and Catholic school when you were growing up?
I went to a military Catholic boarding school.
Well, you got all of them in one fell swoop there.
The triple crown of oppression. I hit all three cylinders there. That was something.
Were you okay at towing the line?
I was. The truth is, there was a wonderful man who was a commandant of this school, Major Ormsby, and I see him to this day, and he was great. And when you're 12 years old, which I was when I went there, you love that sort of thing. You like being in your Class A or your Class B uniform and playing a snare drum and marching in a circle endlessly in the snow. You know, that sort of thing is kind of appealing. It was to me. I liked it. I liked all of that. And it's better than serving in the actual military, which I fortunately never had to do. And so, you know, I enjoyed that.
So you went to school away from girls. Does this help you now in playing the cad roles?
Well, I was, I was a very late starter with women. I had gone to all these boarding schools, military schools, all boys schools, all through high school even. I finally begged my father in 12th grade to let me, you know, go to public school so I could just see what a woman looked like up close just once. And he acquiesced. He allowed me to do that. But I didn't really date or have a girlfriend till I was 21 or 22. I mean, I was into my technical phase. I was a cameraman and kind of a nerd, a guy with a little pen keeper in the pocket, you know, the audiovisual guy. That was the kind of role I had in high school and even in college a bit.
You started acting, I think, when you were 17. You got a role in My Three Sons.
Yeah, I had a role, one episode of My Three Sons. I played a friend of Chip.
Uh-huh.
The middle son, and it was my first break. And it was great to do, but it was kind of a disappointment thereafter because I thought all you had to do was get into Screen Actors Guild and then you would, you know, you'd just work as an actor. They'd be calling from Wagon Train or, you know, whatever other show was shooting at the time, and I'd get a lot of parts. So I did this one part and waited by the phone, but nothing really happened. So then I began to work as a cameraman because I wanted to work in film. I loved film. I began to work as an assistant cameraman, then an operator, and then a DP, a director of photography, and loved that. Did that for a while, and just loved working in film. And then a few years down the line, then the acting thing picked up, so I switched back to that. I always just liked to work. I never liked being idle. So, you know, I worked all those years.
You know, I watch Entertainment Tonight enough to know that so many of the child stars from TV, you know, have had miserable, frustrated lives, you know, becoming alcoholics or feeling that they were lonely and isolated as a child and didn't get to really live normal children's lives. When you were 17 and you had this one episode on My Three Sons, did you look at Chip and the other kids on the show and think, God, I wish I had their life?
Very much so. I wanted to do it from a very early age. I was 3 or 4 when I wanted to be an actor. I wanted to be an actor just like Dad, and then began pursuing it somewhat in earnest when I was 10 years old, going on interviews and not getting them, 11, 12 more interviews, had an agent for a while, didn't get a thing, went up for a wagon train, didn't get it, on and on, went up for all these different parts. Then it finally occurred to me, or someone, maybe my father, that the way you do any job, if you want to be a carpenter or anything, you know, you study carpentry, you know, you take classes. So I began to take acting classes, and I don't think it's a coincidence that soon thereafter I began to get work. And the more you study, the more you work at it, hopefully the better you get.
How do you think being Ed Begley Jr., having the Ed Begley name, affected your career in one way or another?
I look at it as a plus. You can look at it from another point of view, get a slightly different angle on it, and think of it as a negative. You know, I can never be my father's son. How can I fill those shoes? Will I win an Oscar like him? All those silly things that are just pointless to really consider. Or you can take the positive approach, which I decided to do a few years ago, and consider all that's good that goes with it. When I went on job interviews as an actor, it's the same as any job interview. You need, number one, to get them to remember you, which they always would, whether it's me or Rob Reiner or Liza Minnelli, whoever, whenever they were starting out, you remembered. They remember who you are. And then number two, they often had a lot to talk about. It would make the interview more at ease. They'd go, I worked with your dad on Playhouse 90. We did an episode of, you know, the Lux Theater or whatever it was, and they'd have something to talk about. and it would make things go more smoothly often. So that's the feeling I have towards it. I look at it as a plus.
Will you ever drop the junior from your name?
In greetings and stationery and what have you, it's just Ed Begley. But for movie credits and professionally, I think it really has to be Ed Begley Jr. Screen Actors Guild has a rule about it, and I think there's some sense to it. Then you can look and you can see, you know, looking in the TV guide, is it Ed Begley or Ed Begley Jr.? I mean, not everybody knows that he died in 1970, and so they don't have to, you know when Alan Hale died or this one or that. To just, you know, it helps in sorting things out for credits. And more importantly than any of that, for residuals. You want those rerun checks to go to the right person.
Right. Do you wear glasses in real life?
I'm wearing them right now and nothing else.
But you do wear glasses, not contact lenses?
No, I don't wear contacts.
Why not?
I can't get them in my eyes. I can't get drops in my eyes. It'd be hard enough getting an actual piece of matter, soft or hard lens, in there.
So,
sensitive eyes.
So what do you do when you're doing a role in which the character isn't supposed to have glasses?
The term feeling my way through the part has new meaning with me. I literally, it's kind of a braille approach to acting. I can't see much at all. But I can hear by the pitch of the voice if I'm talking to a female or a male person. And it's very helpful in that way. And then often there's a tactile thing that they're very forgiving about, where you can kind of feel your way around the other day players.
Having grown up the son of an actor and now having a couple of kids of your own, are there things that you always swore you would do different if you became an actor and had children?
I swore I would be nothing like my father. And it's a shocking day when you realize, and I realized it years ago, I'm much more like him than I am dislike him. I really am not dissimilar to him at all. You know, things he liked to do. He liked comedy, and he liked to roller skate, and he liked to take pictures, and on and on and on, and many attitudinal moves around the house. You know, I'm very much like him, and that's just the way it is. I think that happens a lot. I think people resist a lot of their parents' habits, and they wind up embracing them at some point in their life, too. But I got some good and some not so good, so I'm very happy the way things turned out, being my father's son.
Thanks a lot for talking with us. Thank you.
Terry, thanks.
Ed Begley stars in the new movie She-Devil. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Next time, a talk with jazz musician, composer, and arranger Jerry Mulligan. I hope you can join us.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. In the 1960s, Fred Flintstone said Yabba Dabba Doo. In the 80s, Homer Simpson says, "There's nothing wrong with a father kissing his son, I think." Homer, his wife, and three children make up The Simpsons, an animated family created by cartoonist Matt Groening. They appear regularly on The Tracey Ullman Show. This season, the family stars in their own Christmas special, and in January, they'll begin a primetime series. Coming up, we talk with their creator, Matt Groening. Also, rock critic Ken Tucker takes a look at how Joni Mitchell's musical style of the 70s still influences other singers. And movie critic Stephen Schiff reviews Enemies, a Love Story, based on a novel by Isaac Bashevis Singer and directed by Paul Mazursky. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. Foreign ministers from both NATO and Warsaw Pact nations have presented draft treaties in Vienna to cut the conventional forces of both sides in Europe. These documents propose cuts in troops, weapons, tanks, and aircraft. It was also announced today that Soviet Foreign Minister Shevardnadze will visit NATO headquarters when he arrives in Brussels next week. Clifford Smith, the BBC, has more.
Mr. Shevardnadze's initiative came up here, appropriately enough, perhaps during a scheduled discussion on how far NATO should go to expand its political role in future. In fact, however, it's not expected that there will be substantive discussions with the Soviet visitor. It looks more like a highly symbolic courtesy visit. Final arrangements are still being worked out. It looks likely, however, that after a discussion with the NATO Secretary General Manfred Werner, Mr. Shevardnadze will meet the assembled ambassadors of the NATO member countries for perhaps a glass of wine. One aim of this arrangement would be to show that NATO is an organization of sovereign states engaged in political consultation. And perhaps there's a hint there for Mr. Shevardnadze about a possible future evolution for the Warsaw Pact.
Clifford Smith of the BBC in Brussels. Southern Lebanon has seen its worst clash in 11 years between Palestinian guerrillas and Syrian troops when Palestinian forces stormed a Syrian army base in an effort to free detained comrades. At least 14 people, including five Syrian soldiers, are reported dead, and more than 30 others were wounded. Mike Theodoulou reports from Nicosia.
Over 100 heavily armed Palestinian commandos from a refugee camp near Sidon crossed the Awali River and stormed the nearby Syrian command post. Security sources said the guerrillas belonged to Yasser Arafat's Fatah organization, although the PLO leader was quick to condemn the attack. The decision to launch the raid, though, may well have been taken at a local level by Fatah commanders. A number of the commandos, Syrian soldiers and local militiamen who took part on both sides, were killed. The attackers have reportedly freed a number of their comrades and took two Syrians hostage. The Syrians have sent more than 1,000 soldiers to the area, leading to fears that they are preparing a retaliatory strike against the Palestinians. To do so, they'll have to cross the Awali River, which could mean a confrontation with Israel, which does not allow a Syrian presence south of the river. For National Public Radio, I'm Mike Theodoulou in Nicosia.
Military officials say that the U.S. Army and Air Force will cut their ranks by a total of about 25,000 people by next October to meet automatic cuts in the current military budget. A Pentagon spokesman says the Navy will absorb its part of the budget cut by changing some current programs. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials closed down almost 8 points to close at 2,753.63 on volume of some 178 million shares. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. The record collections of many baby boomers include well-worn copies of Joni Mitchell's early folky albums. Joni Mitchell has gone on to record albums in new styles, but several current female singers are imitating her old ways. Critic Ken Tucker has a review of some of their efforts, but first, the original from her latest album.
This is the real occurring dream, born in the dreary gap between what we have now
and what we wish we could have.
More fulfilling and less frustrating.
Part of the envy in our eyes. Glamorous picture people rise. Gleaming us down
from screens and pages.
Glamour
before your very eyes.
Isn't it true? Isn't it true?
Good question.
I know. I care.
Look here, they tell you. If you had this, if you had that.
Latest styles and colors.
If we had that for us.
You had the postcard bottle jar, your lovers would
figure this out. Last year, Joni Mitchell put out a perfectly good album called Chalkmark in a Rainstorm. Although I and a number of other reviewers thought it was good, strong stuff, commercially speaking, it stayed around about as long as a chalkmark in a rainstorm. Now, a mere 12 months later, we're surrounded by records that are just glowing with the influence of Joni Mitchell. In fact, these students are so sedulous in their studies, you can frequently even pick out the particular Mitchell album that inspired their music. For example, Sarah Hickman, a Texas folk singer, has certainly been listening to Joni Mitchell's great 1971 album, Blue. Hickman's new debut album, called Equal Scary People, includes a tune called Song for My Father that captures much of Mitchell's dreamy romanticism.
And another day of being afloat, would we still be sending out SOS notes? Would we have given up hope? Given up hope, you and me. With our fingers trailing in the water to keep our burned bodies cool, would we lose ourselves and dive into the world's biggest pool?
For the best dead-on, verging on parody impersonation, though, you have to hear Wendy Wall, whose debut album contains this Joni approximation called Real Love.
Some pick Sally, but the lily of the valley's full of thorns. Watch your finger. Sally loves a dolly or a king in her alley, but the queen has a stinger. Sadie's a lady who don't steal family jewels, she said.
That's Wendy Wall. Mind you, not Wendy Waldman. Wendy Waldman, you might recall, was a Joni Mitchell admirer who made a few Joni-esque albums in the 70s and now writes and produces country records in Nashville. But there are a lot of other junior Jonis to be heard just now. Shawn Colvin is a popular New York-based folk singer. She's got that big yellow taxi kind of Joni sound down pat on the title song of her new album, Steady On.
I was feeling like a miracle. He was steady. I ate it up like a cereal. But it was something like shrapnel.
Other Mitchell sound-alikes include Vonda Shepard and, of course, Jane Sibbery, a Canadian, just like Joni. This is all very odd indeed. The commercial appeal of Mitchell's own work has never been lower, yet her influence is at an all-time high. One explanation for this is fairly simple. These women are using elements of Mitchell's style that Mitchell herself long ago disowned. You know, things like melodic hooks, catchy lyrics, hummable tunes. Mitchell stopped making commercially accessible music after Court and Spark 15 years ago, and it's that album and all the ones before it that the junior Jonis are plundering. Certainly no one is ripping off such later convoluted Joni drags as The Hissing of Summer Lawns or Mingus. None of these performers has hit it really big yet, but if Mitchell wants to attract a bigger audience, she might do well to listen to what aspects of her music her most fervent disciples are picking up on and adjust her own style accordingly.
Ken Tucker writes about popular culture for The Village Voice, LA Weekly, and Spin.
Traveling unraveling, it's the unraveling, and it undoes all the joy that could be. I wanna have fun, I wanna shine like the sun, wanna be the one that you wanna see. Wanna knit you a sweater, wanna write you a love letter, wanna make you feel better, wanna make you feel.
This is Fresh Air. Regular viewers of the Tracy Ullman Show are familiar with the short animated cartoons featuring the Simpson family. The Simpsons were created by cartoonist Matt Groening. Groening also draws the syndicated cartoon strip Life in Hell, starring Binky, a rabbit with bulging eyes and an overbite. The Simpsons also have bulging eyes and overbites. They're about to star in their own weekly primetime cartoon series on the Fox Network. A preview Christmas special called Simpsons Roasting on an Open Fire airs on Sunday. I asked Matt Groening if he would describe The Simpsons as an animated sitcom.
They're more like a hallucination of a sitcom, for me. Anyway, I'm so used to drawing my cartoons and not having them move that when I see these characters actually come to life and strangle each other and shout and yell and laugh and scream, it's like hallucinating, at least for me. And I hope that that experience will be the same for the rest of America.
For our listeners who aren't familiar with The Simpsons yet, describe the family for us.
It's a family of five. There's Homer Simpson, the father.
Ah, son, one day you're going to know the satisfaction of payday, receiving a big fat check for a job well done.
He works in a nuclear power plant. He's a technical supervisor. What that means is a little conveyor belt goes by and he flicks off rocks that aren't glowing. We're trying to endear ourselves to the nuclear power industry with this one. And his wife, Marge, who spends her time trying to keep Homer from strangling the kids.
All right, children, let me have those letters. I'll send them to Santa's workshop at the North Pole.
Oh, please. There's only one fat guy that brings us presents, and his name ain't Santa.
Then there's Bart, an anagram for brat. He's the sort of the center character of the series. He's sort of based on that, you know, that Diane Arbus photo of the little kid in Central Park, you know, grimacing and clutching a little toy gun in shorts. It's sort of based on him. But this woman, Nancy Cartwright, who plays the voice of Bart, made him into more of a hipster. He started saying, hey, man, and he just became more more groovy, more beatnik-like.
Let's get this show on the road, man. We got things to do.
And then he's got a younger sister, Lisa, who's 8 years old and plays the baritone saxophone, can define words that the rest of the family is mystified by. Is generally sensitive, intelligent, gifted, and as a result, completely ignored and misunderstood by the rest of her family.
Aside from the fact that he has the same frailties as all human beings, he's the only father I have. Therefore, he is my model of manhood, and my estimation of him will govern the prospects of my adult relationships.
And then the baby of the family is Maggie, who communicates strictly by sucking on her pacifier in varying rhythms, something like this.
That sounds a lot like it.
Yep.
Well, I remember the first interview we did. You were talking about how you thought of yourself as someone who really couldn't draw very well.
Right.
So now you're drawing your characters for animation, and there's other people helping to animate them, right? Because there's too much to draw every week. So you have all these probably like really talented artists who really know how to draw, and they're drawing your characters?
Well, it's been a real strange experience telling 50 men and women, all of whom can draw very well, to to make their drawings crummier in order to look like my stuff. It's kind of exhilarating, although, you know, when you walk away and you hear them muttering, you know, you can feel taken aback. And their caricatures of me at the animation studio are downright vicious.
So now that you have all these, you know, talented artists drawing your characters, do you ever worry that something of the edge will be lost in the characters because there's a smoothness that they could bring to the drawings?
Yeah, it's been a real struggle to keep the to keep a certain
roughness.
Yeah, roughness and abruptness and jerkiness. On working on this show are animators from Hanna-Barbera and Disney and great virtuoso independent projects, and they all bring their own attitude and aesthetic philosophy to the project, and it's been a real struggle to make sure that everybody gets in line and has the same vision and or at least looking in the same direction. As an example, almost every animator today worships Tex Avery.
Avery is one of the Looney Tunes guys.
Well, one of the Looney Tunes guys did you know, he's the guy that had eyeballs popping out of wolves' heads and their tongues falling to the floor very exaggerated, very violent, really jazzy stuff, brilliant stuff. And that's not what we're trying to do in The Simpsons. Our cartoon effects are not beep, boing, chonk, you know, and all those kind of crazy effects that you got imprinted on your brain. They're more realistic. And it's a slightly different kind of humor, and it takes a while to get the hang of.
Did you have to draw... I don't know if it's called a Bible or not, but did you have to draw what each of your characters look like from different angles and in motion so that the animators would know how the characters look?
Yes. Mike's stuff is basically, I see it two-dimensionally. It's very flat, and I draw my characters almost always from a three-quarter profile. And the animators had to come up with ways of showing them from straight on and from behind. Those are angles that I rarely, if ever, use in my own work. But even tougher than that was we created a 8-inch-high Bart head in clay for the Bart Simpson talking doll, which is due in your local toy stores if the show is a hit. And I'm really proud of this doll because he gets to say a number of outrageous things. The only thing the toy company wouldn't let me have him say is, I'm Bart Simpson, who the hell are you? They felt that that was too much to come out of a kid's toy. They also wouldn't let him burp, which I was very disappointed by. But
so what,
maybe
what,
that in the next time.
What does he say?
My favorite thing is, kids in TV land, you're being duped. I had a lot of flack over that because they said kids aren't going to know what the word duped means. So I offered the substitute brainwashed, but they didn't go for that.
Your character, Bart, and as you pointed out, it's an acronym for brat.
Yeah.
I'm wondering what kinds of things you pulled when you were a kid that drove your parents crazy.
I got in trouble an awful lot in school as I was growing up. I had a strong sense of injustice, and if I felt I was being treated unfairly, I let those around me know it. You know, I may make light of the fact that I did it's stuff that got me in trouble, but I got in trouble for doing stuff that I should be rewarded for. I mean, I got in trouble for making comics. I got in trouble for, you know, putting on little plays and stuff. All this creative stuff was completely squelched and ignored. I got mad one time and I dropped an encyclopedia out the window. Okay, so, you know, it's that kind of thing.
Didn't land on anybody, did it?
No, it didn't, but they could have, and that's why I had to write the 1,000-word essay on why not to throw encyclopedias. In fact, I seem to have, I probably have in my files a whole sheaf of essays. I have why not to drop encyclopedias out the window, why I must remain quiet in class, and my favorite was why I must not throw rotten apples, because I did throw a rotten apple into the air, and it landed on a kid's head, and I got in trouble for it. So I had to write why not to throw rotten apples, and I got in further trouble for my essay because it was a single sentence in which I just said, well, you shouldn't throw a rotten apple because it might fly across the street and break the window of a grocery store, and the shards of glass might cut someone, and then the person might stagger out into the street, get hit by a car, which, trying to veer out of the way, runs over a neighborhood dog who is taken to the hospital, and, you know, and on and on and on.
A lot of your cartoons seem to draw on childhood experiences or childhood feelings that you had. Do you think your memories of childhood are any more vivid than your average person's memories of childhood?
I think that if people think hard, they can recall the same kind of stuff I did. But I got to say, one difference between most people and me is, at the time, I had a feeling that something was terribly wrong, and so I took notes. I kept diaries when I was a kid, so I have a huge backlog of evidence to back me up in my ideas about kids' life. Also, a lot of humor about children is based on the idea that kids' traumas are cute and trivial and inconsequential. And, you know, the fact is, for kids, many of those little inconsequential traumas are not so inconsequential. They're actually great big deals, and they have no way of standing back from the conflicts in their lives. And in my stuff, I try to take those traumas and deal with them on their level.
You are a father now.
Yep.
Your baby will be 1 year old in March, I believe?
Yep.
So are you starting to see things now more from the parent's perspective than the kid perspective?
I've really painted myself into a corner. I've done all this stuff that, positively takes the side of the kid, and now I'm on the other side. I'm a dad. But I'm not going to draw comics about my kid. I'm tempted to, and people keep on saying, oh, we expect parenthood as hell. I don't think I want to give him any ammunition for his therapy 20 years from now.
For a Daddy Dearest book.
Right. But, it's going to be fun. It is fun.
Well, I wish you a Merry Christmas special.
Happy holidays.
Matt Groening's animated TV series The Simpsons begins in January on the Fox Network. The Simpsons Christmas special airs Sunday.
Well, the reindeer loved him, and they shouted out with glee. Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer, you'll go down in history.
Why the tail of the
You little...
This is Fresh Air. Let's check in with Robert Siegel and see what's coming up on All Things Considered. More on your series on guns?
There will be on the program more. Today, a murder in the by gun in a Maryland suburb of Washington, D.C. And we'll also be hearing a report today from Sandy Tolan about Senator Dennis DeConcini, once a darling of the gun lobby, but now a proponent of a ban on some assault weapons. That has made some of Senator DeConcini's former friends his political adversaries, those who fancy a continued use and sales of assault rifles in the country. Also, news of the presidential election in Chile and what's going on in Bulgaria.
Thank you, Robert. That and more coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Enemies, A Love Story, is a new movie based on a novel by Nobel Prize winner Isaac Bashevis Singer. Film critic Stephen Schiff has this review.
What do women want? That was the question that Freud found he could never answer. But what do men want? Easy. What a man wants in a woman is three things. Someone to protect and care for him, someone who can be a soulmate and a pal, and someone who can fulfill his sexual dreams. Lucky is the man who finds all three someones in a single woman. Rather less lucky, though, is Herman Broder, played by Ron Silver in Enemies, A Love Story. For though he's found all three, he's unfortunately found them in three distinct women. And long before the end of Paul Mazursky's wonderful new film, he's married to all of them at the same time. The situation is the stuff of farce, but the laughs skate on top of a current of tragedy. Enemies, A Love Story takes place in New York in 1949, and Herman and his three women have all just lived through the Holocaust. Life in the jazzy cornucopia of post-war New York still shimmers around them like a dream, but it's a dream they can glimpse only through the terrifying fog of their memories. Out of gratitude, Herman has married the woman who saved him from the Nazis, a simple, doting Polish servant girl, wonderfully played by the Polish actress Margaret Sophie Stein. But whenever he can, Herman sneaks up to the Bronx to be with Masha, a gorgeous, tormented survivor of the camps, who's played by Lena Olin. And just when he seems about to come apart at the seams, his first wife, whom everyone believed dead, suddenly shows up. She's played by Angelica Houston, with a world-weary insouciance that takes your breath away. And when she sees what her Herman's been up to, she can only marvel.
This sweetheart of yours, does she accept this arrangement?
She has no choice. Her husband won't divorce her. She's in love with me.
Are you in love with her?
She can't live without her.
Well, well, well. To hear such words from you, is she beautiful, intelligent, charming?
All three.
How do you manage it? Do you rush from one to the other?
I do the best I can.
Poor Herman spends most of the movie running from one woman to the next, desperately trying to juggle his terrible secrets. He's also a ghostwriter for a crassly ambitious rabbi played to the hilt by Alan King, and ghosting is a fitting occupation for a man who ought to be dead, a man who spent most of the war hiding from the Nazis in a barn, and who now embraces life, especially sex life, with the fervent eagerness of one who was nearly deprived of it. Besides, Herman has learned to be as elusive as a ghost. He's never quite come out of hiding, and he's as furtive and guilty about pursuing his new religion, love, as he once was about practicing Judaism. In Enemies, Paul Mazursky, who directed and co-wrote, has made his richest film yet. And I say that not just because of the gorgeous period recreations by the production designer Pato Guzman, or the exhilarating klezmer music on the soundtrack. Mazursky's direction achieves the sort of delicacy of tone that we're used to finding only in the greatest of European directors. He walks the line between comedy and tragedy with a confidence bordering on bravado, so that by the end you may feel that he's captured the paradoxical essence of the survival experience. That survival can make one hungry for life in a way that may finally prove unbearable. The performances are, all of them, extraordinary, but Angelica Houston hasn't been this good since Pritzi's Honor, and the fiery Lena Olin, who was in The Unbearable Lightness of Being, is absolutely mesmerizing here. Sensual and desperate and furious, everything the Sophie of Sophie's Choice should have been. As for Enemies, a Love Story, surely this is the best movie of the year.
Stephen Schiff is critic at large for Vanity Fair. Amy Sallet and Phyllis Myers produced the interviews on Fresh Air with research assistance from Sue Spolin. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, by this and other NPR member stations, and by grants from the National Endowment for the Arts. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we meet jazz musician, composer, and arranger Jerry Mulligan. And we talk about concerned photography with Cornell Kappa, the founder of the International Center of Photography. I'm Terry Gross, and I hope you'll join me for the next Fresh Air.